Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today marks the beginning of a mini Oscar Wilde Festival here in our city as Theater Tulsa presents Wilde's most popular play, The Importance of Being Earnest. As conceived by guest director Clayton Hodges, it presents Wilde's classic comedy in a post-apocalyptic, futuristic world that shares the same concerns of class and mores as Victorian England. Plus, the University of Tulsa is presenting a two-day conference on Oscar Wilde and the law today and tomorrow at the TU Law School, featuring Robert Spoo and Merlin Holland, the only grandson of Wilde, plus scholars from around the country. My guest today is a part of both events. Clayton Hodges is the guest director for Theater Tulsa's production of Oscar Wilde's classic. Hodges is currently a Los Angeles-based film and theater actor, writer, and director. He's a Tulsa native and was a student at the New York University Tisch School of the Arts and American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco. The Importance of Being Earnest opens tomorrow night at the Tulsa PAC and continues through November 17th. And in addition, Hodges will be presenting a theatrical version of Oscar Wilde's essay, The Critic as Artist, this Sunday, two performances at 2 o'clock at Philbrook Museum and Sunday evening at 7 at the Tulsa PAC. Clayton Hodges joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Clayton, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us, and welcome back home.
My pleasure to be here. I'm excited to discuss our exciting new collaboration.
How did this opportunity come about? You're working in Los Angeles now. You grew up here, but been away for some time, except for probably family visits. How did this opportunity with Theater Tulsa come about?
Well, it all started because my old friend, Sarah Phoenix, who's the Theater Tulsa board president and artistic director, she is looking to do new classics, reinventing some of their favorites for the modern audiences. Even though they've been working for 91 years in Tulsa, they're really looking to bring in new audiences for theater. And that really meshes with my aesthetic as a director and theatrical producer. What I do is I reinvigorate the classics, bringing timeless works and making them new and fresh for timely audiences. So that's exactly what we're doing with Earnest, so it just sort of dovetailed nicely.
Give us a sense of some of the other things you've done where you've reimagined classics.
Absolutely, sure. The Macbeth project was a favorite piece of mine where I subverted the gender roles and making them a lot more fresh and new. I like to keep the original language of the text while updating the references to make more sense for the modern audience.
Mm-hmm. Of course, Macbeth is one that's always being reinvented, but yeah. you mess with gender because, you know, we think of the wimpy Lord Macbeth and Lady Macbeth is the real power there.
Oh, absolutely. And also the witches are representing a prehistorical society where women that were living separate from the society were looked down upon. Mm-hmm. And I subverted that to give them more of the power in society because I feel like, you know, the gender roles that are explored in Shakespeare's time have a set structure, much like in Earnest. And by flipping it on its head, you can show and illuminate more about the gender roles of today.
Now, Oscar Wilde, when he wrote this was Victorian England. He was on the verge of being sort of steamrolled by the class system. And, of course, The Importance of Earnest basically tweaks that class system and the hypocrisy of the class system in Victorian England. So you're taking this production of Earnest to a very different place, a post-apocalyptic future where all of a sudden class, which, you know, maybe outside of Hyannisport and a few places on the west end of London is gone in the English-speaking world, has reemerged just as strongly as Victorian England.
Well, that's actually not true. I think the class system exists across the world and especially in the English-speaking UK. He did write it in 1895 as a skewer of Victorian society. And unfortunately, a lot of his barbs and jabs have dulled a bit with age because of our societal advances. So an updating and rebooting was necessary for sure. But when the rich people reemerge from their bomb shelters after the apocalypse, they still need societal rules to entertain themselves, these arcane sort of games and these mystery lives that they lead that were so popular back in the Victorian days. And I love science fiction, so of course I knew I wanted to update it to a post-apocalyptic London, the year 2126. So after the bomb shelters have reemerged, the rich people still need to worry about what to do on an everyday because they have nothing to do. They don't have to worry about survival like the folks that are outside of the enclaves. So it's still a trivial comedy for serious people, but a lot of the references have been updated for the modern audience to make more sense and to really reinvigorate the text.
And give us a sense of what your world looks like. Does it look a lot like the Victorian world in any sort of way? I mean, because when you're talking about steampunk, steampunk was Victorian.
That's right. It is steampunk meets science fiction meets British sitcom. So it's still very much a comedy, but it has elements of technology. For example, each of the characters carries a device, much like we carry our iPhones today. This device interacts with the computers in their house, and you will see on screen, we have a very large projection technological element in the show. So they're always interacting with the technology. And instead of searching for the answers in books or in directories, much of the farcical plot depends on finding out the information of the true identities of these characters. They're looking online, they're looking in the databases of the future. They're checking out emails, they're checking out all of their devices to find this information. So we keep that farcical plot because that is how the play makes sense, right? That is how farce, through its twists and turns and intricacies, makes sense to the audience. But we update the jabs so that the audiences can enjoy the intent of Wilde's text.
Now, you said you're going to keep the language pretty much the same, but the references are different.
That's
so
right.
Obviously, instead of looking up a book, you're going to look up, you're going to Google it or whatever your plot suggests.
Right.
But what other sort of references did you have to change?
Well, for example, he mocks the institution of marriage a lot. That's one of his most favorite places to land his biting humor. So we envision a future where marriage is available to all. So instead of mocking a person flirting across the dinner table with her husband, in this one, she is flirting with her own wife. Also, he is talking about being banished to Australia. Now, nowadays, Australia is not a bad place to be banished to, but in the
maybe we're not right now with the fires.
That's right. But in the 19th century, it was the worst place.
Yes,
it was imagined being banished to a penal colony. So in this production, it's the Canadian colony on Mars, and New Toronto is one of the worst places to be banished to. So it's things like that that bring us very squarely into this world without anachronism. All of the formalities of society are seen as essential to the promulgation of the rich people's gene pool.
Of course, one of the geniuses of this play is this hypocrisy that's at a part of the Victorian, which is the upper class certainly don't want to give up their place in society, but they feel hidebound by that place and those social structures, and they're always looking for a way out of it. And often will find a way out of it. And of course, that's the case with Algernon and Jack.
Absolutely, and Oscar himself was always looking to get into a higher place in society. This play really mirrors his search for acceptance in society despite his peccadilloes of his past. Algernon and Jack both are looking for love. They really do want to find love. Algernon seems to try to be finding it in dalliances all over, which is what he's doing with Bunburying. Mm-hmm. But it also mirrors the financial problems that Oscar himself felt, because he wrote the play really as a chance to make money, to capitalize on his previous successes. And we tend to forget that. We tend to forget when we realize what a saint he was in terms of having the effect on the English language. But he really did have a unique place in trying to capitalize on the public's need for this satire at this particular time. The public was ready for it, and he hit the nail on the head at the exact time.
With Wilde's language, you have to leave that there. It's like you can't change Shakespeare. You really can't change Wilde's language. You're changing some of the references, but tell us about the process of adapting the script so a reference, say, to Australia, to someplace new, makes sense, and what can't you touch?
You can't go into this process thinking that everything is sacrosanct. Generally, as an actor, when I work, that's how I work, that every word is sacrosanct. Mm-hmm. But as an adapter of material, you have to believe that this rough material is there for you to change and make new and make better with your vision. Oscar Wilde actually talks a lot about this in his work, The Critic as Artist. He believes that the critic, the true cultured spirits of each age, the elect spirits, are really more creative than the artist. And they use the rough material of the artist to make something more marvelous, more enduring in the eyes of men, and more true. And so you, as an adapter, are really creating something that has a bigger life, a longer life than the artist's work.
Well, you found a setting. You found a place where manners and class means as much as Victorian England. tell us about the process of creating the rest of this world.
A big part of it was casting. So I knew that when I wanted to come to Tulsa, I wanted to look for the talented actors that have been working with Theater Tulsa and other groups here. Sarah Phoenix was integral in helping that to happen. Also, I had to collaborate with designers and artists that were on the same page with my artistic vision. Luckily, we were able to find a collaborator in a sound designer, Nick Nelson from Brooklyn. He's another former Tulsan. We have a great carpenter for set design. We have wonderful light designer, professional lighting designer, and props and costumes. And this video projection is really the key that ties it all together. We're lucky enough to find a great animator to animate all the sequences for us. So in terms of culminating the entire vision together, it takes a village for sure, but everyone has to be on with the vision. And luckily, we would have been able to find a team that's pretty much on board.
One of the things I read is you pretty much put some Easter eggs from Oscar Wilde's life or from a typical Victorian production into this piece.
Sure. So one difference that we have between Acts 1 and Acts 2 and Act 3 are this dichotomy between city and country. So the country in the apocalypse was left relatively unscathed.
So we go back to a Victorian setting. A Victorian,
not quite.
Okay.
Not quite. But it doesn't certainly doesn't have the technology of the future apartments in London. They have a lot less technology. A lot of the structures, the physical structures, have probably already been left intact. So you will see flashes of Victorian parlor color, whereas the future in the cities is more urban, more gritty, more gray.
Brutalist, maybe, in a way?
Definitely more austere.
Mm-hmm.
But the future does have all of the technology for all of the folks, even in the country. So you'll still see a lot of the technology, but you'll see them using it in a different way. You mentioned Easter eggs. For example, we talk about the address of Jack's in the country, and I've changed the number of his address. Not only have I changed the postcode system, because in the future they use decimal points and stuff like that, but I've changed the address to C3.3, which I'm not sure if you know the reference, but it was actually Oscar Wilde's prisoner number when he was in Reading Jail.
Oh, wow.
So now everyone's going to come and see and know that, but there's other Easter eggs like that we're going to leave for folks to find out.
All right. My guest today is Clayton Hodges, who's a guest director. He's now working in Los Angeles as an actor and director. Grew up in Tulsa and has come back home to be the guest director for Theater Tulsa's production of The Importance of Being Earnest by Oscar Wilde, which runs this Friday through November 17th at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. Well, as you were in the process of adapting this, I mean, you're messing with a classic, so I assume you had other sets of eyes to give you a sense, okay, this is the right track, or can you talk about the process of, I don't know if you had a dramaturge formally, but I'm sure you had it informally. What was the reaction when you said,
Actually, no, not at all. This vision came out of my head almost fully formed. When Sarah asked me to work on this project, I knew that I wanted to do something different. I knew I wanted to be in the science fiction realm. And as soon as I hit upon steampunk and blending the science fiction genres, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. Oscar Wilde goes on in The Critic as Artist to talk about the critic asserting his own individualism, because that is one of the primary requisites of the true critic, and he does mean the cultured, elect, true artists in his vision. So if I were to bring somebody in at this point when I was first starting to build my vision, it might have taken me a bit off track. You know, when I've had these collaborators, these artistic collaborators working with me, and they veered away from the vision a bit, I've had to rein them in and to bring them in more in focus with my vision. Oscar Wilde felt that way about all of his pieces, even though he himself made changes. He actually originally wrote Ernest as a four-act structure with an entire new storyline about Jack Worthing being pursued for debt collection by a debt collector. And that act was excised by his manager, George Alexander.
Yeah, that's going too far.
That's right. Well, it was actually very close to Oscar Wilde's life at the time.
Uh-huh.
But he even was editing his own works based on not just concerns that he had about the manager putting on the play, but also what he thought. And when he sat down to work on a piece, he was completely focused. The thing was, he didn't work that much. So when he worked 2 hours a day or 3 hours a day, he was completely focused on working. And the rest of the time, he was off living his life of aestheticism.
Yeah. I want to get back to the question about the cast. You said you had a specific look that you wanted for the mm-hmm. cast. So give us a sense. We have a notion of what this comedy of manners look like and the people who are in it. Sounds like you
That's
have a
right.
very different vision of that. We're talking tattoos. We're talking, you know, hipster look as far as the
right.
costuming. Give us a sense.
That's right. So the future is going to look a lot different than 1895 in London. Even London today looks different. It's much more ethnically diverse. There are more of a sort of hipster vibe, as you said. But my future has the multi-ethnicities of that already inherent in it. So I knew when I was coming here, I was looking for talented actors of all ethnicities and all races. It also has a more wide swath of sexual identities, gender identities. So as I mentioned to you, the references aren't just about men and women getting married, but also the difference in the culture.
Mm-hmm.
So I was looking for Miss Prism to be in drag, which uh-huh. would have been a great thing, but I found something even better and different, which I'll wait for the audiences to see. The joke is that at the very end of the play, that as Jack is being revealed who his true identity is, he thinks that Miss Prism is his mother. And the joke in the play is that Miss Prism can't be his mother because she's unmarried, which of course in Victorian society would be the worst thing to have a child out of wedlock.
Right.
Well, it's revealed that she is a man, which is why she can't be his mother. We also have an Indian-American actor. Actually, he is from India, so he is an Indian actor playing Jack Worthing. And there are references to Moncrief, his actual father, serving on the Indian subcontinent. And I had started to layer in references to the East Asian culture in London. And so that somehow just fit nicely. It just actually ended up working perfectly. Another example is the Church of England rector, Dr. Chasuble, in the original production. In my production, is more of a holy man. He's a medicine man of the future. So he goes by the one-word moniker of Chasuble. And he really does have these healing properties as opposed to a fumbling vicar of the past.
My guest today is Clayton Hodges. He is the guest director for Theater Tulsa's updating of Oscar Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest, which runs Friday through November 17th at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. And Clayton, in addition, will be doing a staged performance, I guess, a reading performance of The Critic as Artist
yes.
by Oscar Wilde. You'll be doing that this Sunday at 2 and 7, one at Philbrook Museum and the other at the Tulsa PAC. You've made several references to The Critic as Artist. I assume this was sort of a guiding statement that guided this adaptation.
The Critic as Artist has changed the way I view art, art history, aestheticism, views on critical thinking. It is really a who's who of modern Western history up until the point Oscar Wilde wrote it in 1890s. He was touring America before The Importance of Being Earnest was written, and he was giving lectures on his views on all sorts of topics from interior design to aestheticism. He also liked to hold forth in conversation, as we know about Oscar Wilde, in dinner parties and with his friends and lovers at his various places he lived in London. So the conversation between the two Wildean characters in The Critic as Artist is really seminal in terms of the way Wilde created his views. So he wrote this as a Socratic dialogue, really a dialectical essay in two parts with two characters, with one neophyte character asking leading questions like, what do you mean by that? And then him going on and on for several pages. I was originally asked to do this piece at the Art Institute in San Francisco about 10 years ago for a criticism conference in which they studied the piece as the basis of modern aestheticism. I didn't know what I was getting myself into when I took on that show, but through a process of gradually working with the material, I really adapted it into a very tight 90-minute presentation. It is a stage reading, so there are scripts in hands, but there's a theatrical device in which the scripts in the hands make sense between two characters, and it's really entertaining, thought-provoking. There are some Wildean quips that he quotes in other places like his plays, but it really is the genesis of this theory of aestheticism and what I've referenced to in this mm-hmm. interview already about his views on the artistic value of artists is only valuable insofar as it gives to the critic a true sense of calling. And he speaks very candidly and very pointedly about the difference between literature and journalists, meaning the critics in the three penny papers, as right. being just the reporters at the police court of literature, right?
Yeah,
reportings,
right.
Reporting on the habitual doings of people of no interest whatsoever, which is sometimes when critics today even write critical reviews of pieces, they just give a recap.
Right.
And he sees the critic as someone of actually ever evolving, moving forward.
A philosophical criticism.
There you go.
Yeah.
So the presentation is going to be partnered with Philbrook. I'm also partnering with another former Tulsan professional actor out of Chicago named Stuart Ritter, who's coming down for the presentation. We'll be doing it at Philbrook at 2 p.m. and then again doing it at the PAC that night.
All right. Also, The Importance of Being Earnest will be running Friday through November 17th by Theater Tulsa. We haven't talked about the cast. Tell us a little bit about the people in the cast. And I mean, what do you like about the way the cast looks?
Well, you know, they have the look, the aesthetic I'm going for. I even have the two lead guys growing facial hair because we're going to have them cutting it into a sort of a hipstery facial hair vibe. So I'm growing some facial hair myself to kind of give them some support on that. No, they've jumped right in. They've been on board. The one thing that I want to say working in Tulsa is that I don't believe that because you don't live in New York and you don't live in Los Angeles or you're not getting paid for your work, that should be an excuse for inferior work. That's something that I've taught all of my students, and I teach in the college level all the way down to middle school, and I do teach adults as well, that the non-professional should have just as much high standards as the professional actor. And in fact, professional acting, if you can call it as such, just getting paid for it, doesn't necessarily mean it's a guarantee of good work. So I aspire for the actors in the Earnest Company to shoot for better standards than they might themselves have been satisfied with before. And all of them have been 100% on board with that. One thing they all share is they all have experience or an intense desire to learn from this process. So it's actors that folks may have seen in Theater Tulsa productions. They may have seen in other productions around town. But it is an eclectic group that is all on board with the vision and really believes that they can achieve the greatness that Oscar Wilde would have intended. And in fact, you know, he said on opening night that when somebody asked him, is it going to be a success? He said, I'm not sure about that. We're going to see if the first night audience will be a success. So Oscar Wilde himself would have approved, I think, of the effort that is being put into the show with the cast.
Now, you grew up in Tulsa. Did you do local theater as you were growing up, or did that come really after you left Tulsa?
No, everything I could get my hands on.
Theater Tulsa?
Tulsa, absolutely. And I also worked in organizations like Theater South, Theater North. I worked through my church, through my high school at Booker T. Washington. Mm-hmm. Every single thing I could get my hand on, I knew I wanted to be a professional actor since I was 10 years old. So it was never a question of what I was going to do. I was always doing as much as I could. When I graduated from Booker T., that's when I went out to New York and really began working as a professional actor. And since then, I've worked all over the U.S. and toured all around, putting 13,000 highway miles of touring under my belt.
Wow.
I had a theater company for many years in New York. We performed in London, had a partnership with a theater there, and that's where my aesthetic of really reinvigorating the classics was developed.
Now, you're based in Los Angeles now. Are you directing or acting or whatever you can get? You're kind of the freelancer, right?
That's
at this
right.
point.
You know, people that work in L.A. really are based there because they want to make money in TV and film, mm-hmm. and that's part of the reason why I moved there. But the funny thing is that I've worked more out of the city since moving to L.A., and I've worked more in theater since moving to L.A. than any other city I've lived in the U.S. I do book work out of L.A., but it takes me away from my home. I've worked in San Diego this year, New York, Vegas, Tulsa, San Francisco. So I'm always looking for the next job and planning ahead, but ostensibly I am in L.A. to make the money from TV and film. And when I get back, that's my next focus.
All right. Well, we wish you great success with that and great success with The Importance of Being Earnest. Sounds like a very interesting vision and a production worth seeing. Clayton, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Los Angeles-based film and theater actor, writer, and director Clayton Hodges speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He's the guest director for Theater Tulsa's production of the Oscar Wilde classic, The Importance of Being Earnest, which opens tomorrow night at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center and continues with performances through November 17th. In addition, Hodges will be presenting a theatrical version of Oscar Wilde's essay, The Critic as Artist, this Sunday at 2 at Philbrook Museum of Art and Sunday evening at 7 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. For information about both productions, visit theatertulsa.org. Hodges will also be a participant in the Oscar Wilde and the Law Conference presented by the University of Tulsa Law School today and tomorrow at John Rogers Hall on the TU campus, featuring a wide variety of scholars, including Merlin Holland, the only grandson of Oscar Wilde himself. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Barry Friedman.
A Daughter Goes to Oregon, Part 3, This Saying Goodbye. We have been on the road since 7 in the morning, about 14 hours. We pull into the driveway of 144 Roxanne Place in Medford, and it's still raining. I hear it does that a lot up here. She hugs her boyfriend, I hug her boyfriend, and thanks to Bob Dylan, Tina Dico, Regina Spektor, Coldplay, Randy Newman, and the Japanese engineers responsible for the 2001 Toyota Echo, we made it. Yes, Dylan and Coldplay, the compromises you make when you're a parent. They drive me to a hotel, the Town Place Suites, and leave me with the leftover licorice pretzels and Diet Coke, and they go back to their new apartment and do what 20-somethings do on an air mattress. All is not right with the world, but in Medford, Oregon, at the moment, things are good. And yeah, this too, the Town Place Suites has a breakfast buffet. Friday. They're taking me to Ashland, Oregon today, but first breakfast at a place that makes sandwiches on biscuits. It's still raining. We head to the winery where Ari works. I am the father in the car asking stupid questions. God help me. God help them. At the winery, we recreate the scene in Godfather II where Vito and the family return to Sicily and the vineyard to toast family and success, and then he goes to stab Don Cheech in the heart. It's touching. My daughter knows more about wine than I thought. She won't spit, though, between tastes. I try a red, a white, something else. I really need a Diet Coke. That night in Ashland, I hear two street people talking. One says to me, we could use pizza, beer, and $100. The other one says, help two dirty kids get clean. At dinner, I sit across the table and watch my daughter kiss my future son-in-law, watch my daughter kiss the future father of my grandchildren. It's not a bad feeling. Saturday. Another goodbye. This is the third time we've done this. The first was when Nina was in school in Norman. We sat in her dorm room at OU. I tried to hook up her television, and she tried to explain to her mother what was wrong. The second time, Nina went to study in France and India, and I sat in the terminal at Tulsa International and ate a scone. And now we are here again at another airport in the Rogue County International Airport. She hasn't cried since the bagels in Tulsa. I haven't either. You could stay like this forever, because she won't let me go, her arms around my neck. You're the best dad in the world, she says. It's a game we've played since she was a little girl. I tell her there's something about fathers and daughters, something about this father and this daughter. She's heard it before. I am thinking of a Paul Simon song at the moment, and not even a very good one at that. And the lyrics are, as long as one and one is two, there could never be a father who loved his daughter more than I love you. I'd like to think it's true. This saying goodbye. Through security, I look back. She won't stop waving and throwing kisses. This saying goodbye. It gets easier. It doesn't get easier.
Barry Friedman is a columnist for Tulsa People magazine, a comic, a writer, an essayist, and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available to listen to online anytime on demand at publicradiotulsa.org. Just search for Studio Tulsa and you can look through our archives for past programs. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.